Hi, Amjad.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm doing okay, thanks. Yourself?
I'm doing okay. I imagine we'd both be in a better mood if this speech of Mubarak had gone a little differently. I should say that you're Amjad Atallah at the New America Foundation, and you study the Middle East. And maybe you can enlighten me as to kind of what just happened. There was, of course, the widespread expectation that in this speech, Mubarak would either actually step down or at a minimum technically remain president but transfer authority to his vice president and presumably announce something else that might cheer up the crowd. But it was a big disappointment. What do you make of this?
Well, there were obviously mixed signals. I mean, there were signals that came from the army. They had that meeting that they broadcast in which Omar Suleiman and Hosni Mubarak were not at the meeting. There were the announcements that the military was going to protect the people and be with the people. There were announcements on state television in Egypt suggesting, as you just did, that Hosni Mubarak was about to accede in some way to the wishes of the masses. And there was a delay, of course, for about an hour, I guess, from when he was supposed to speak. And then the tape, I don't know if it was live or not, but either his speech or the tape of his speech went on. And it was clear that there was a complete and total disconnect between what the president was speaking to the public about and what the public had expected him to hear. And the amazing thing is that throughout the day, hundreds of thousands more people were pouring into the square in anticipation mm-hmm. of his resignation speech. And mm-hmm. so he had as big and as wide an audience as he possibly could have had to enrage. And it seems that this speech is actually, I mean, I think that tonight every city in Cairo is actually unbelievably on edge, and tomorrow is Friday, the day that typically they've been able to get the largest amount of demonstrators together.
So this because for one good. Thing, tomorrow's the day of worship, right? And the mosques can be an organizing center for this, right?
Well, it's generally been the case, and it's generally been the case that on Friday after prayers, after afternoon prayers, people pour out to join the demonstrations in Medan Tahrir. However, I mean, it's important to note that there are lots and lots of Egyptian Christians who have been part of these demonstrations as well.
Right, that's true. Now, so I had taken the army to be saying earlier, we're taking control. Was I reading too much into that?
Well, I mean, all of us were, I think. All the news announcers were, everybody who heard it was. And I think we might be seeing a difference of opinion within the army as to how this can be handled. But I think from President Mubarak's perspective, I think what we're really seeing is a bit about the psychopathy of power. It's clear that he associates the state with himself. He doesn't see himself as a politician in the state. He doesn't see himself No. as an individual running the state on behalf of the people. He interprets Right. the state as himself. And the way he was talking, it was as if he left, he was somehow betraying Egypt. If he left, he would be killing Egypt. Mm-hmm. In fact, obviously the opposite is true.
So, I mean, the reason I ask about the military is the darkest interpretation of this is that, yes, the military is telling people, look, we're in charge here, and then you put that alongside the speech we just heard, and they're saying, and we're digging in our heels alongside Mubarak. I hope that's an unwarranted interpretation, but does that seem crazy?
No, I mean, I think that is that has to be one plausible possibility. The question is, if the army decides to go down this route, if this is the way the army wants to keep charge, I mean, getting rid of scapegoating Hosni Mubarak is the easiest way for the army to stay in charge.
Sure.
But if they're refusing even to scapegoat him, if they can't actually get rid of him and attempt to pretend they're, you know, acceding to the wishes of the people. In fact, it may actually lead to more significant real change than might otherwise have happened. I mean, imagine if Hosni Mubarak had resigned in the speech a few minutes ago and the army effectively took charge and led a transition that effectively left them with all the reins of power. Then the revolution, in effect, would have failed. But by in effect, hanging their hat with him, I think that they're going to mean that this revolution is actually going to be a make or break. I mean, they're actually pushing
the people.
Well,
yeah, but it also means that the make could be pretty ugly, right? I mean, we're talking revolution in the most dramatic sense. If the army digs in its heels with Mubarak, and we may well be talking about a revolution that fails, but one that if it succeeds, won't succeed without considerable bloodshed, right?
Or you may see one in which the army itself fragments.
Is divided because the troops themselves, many of the troops themselves, are siding with the people here.
Right. I mean, remember the Shah of Iran. He ordered the troops to mow down. I mean, the protesters in the Iranian Revolution were unarmed and were peaceful demonstrators for the most part. When he ordered the troops to mow them down, literally to mow them down, at a certain point in time, they just wouldn't take any orders anymore. And that was when he had to leave. The army in Egypt has not actually weighed in. I mean, it has not tried to shoot at the demonstrators. It has stood by and let others do it, but it hasn't actually engaged them. And there has been no sign that they're willing to do so. If they change, I mean, that would be a disaster. That would be a double disaster for Egypt.
Well, and just kind of crazy because, you know, I understand that the people at the top of the army want to protect their own interests. They want to remain in power. Fine, but it seems to me there was a way for them to remain in power and oversee a transition to any number of things, including a post-Mubarak era that wasn't really democratic and a post-Mubarak era that was really democratic. And it seems to me they have the power to choose either of those, and that's almost certainly going to be better for them in the long run than digging in their heels with Mubarak, right?
I mean, I would agree with you. I don't know the problem is we don't actually know what's happening in the back rooms. When things like this are happening, they're not happening because 100 people are making a decision. There are probably only 10 people right now in Cairo that are part of the regime that are actually involved in decision making and trying to figure out exactly what steps need to be taken. And each one has to watch his back. Each person is actually probably thinking, yeah, but if I push this, somebody's going to put a bullet in my head. If I push that, I may not survive to the next day. And so, you know, it's a high game, it's a high stakes game right now that they're all playing with each other. It's hard to predict, you know, who. I mean, it would be great. Everybody always hopes. It's obvious the Egyptian masses that are out in the street are hoping effectively for a kind of hero soldier or a hero general to step forward and put an end to this and move Egypt towards a representative form of government. But so far there hasn't been, all the heroes have been the ones that are on the side of the demonstrators. There haven't been any heroes in the army yet.
No, and my point is it wouldn't take tremendous heroism because, maybe you're right, and I don't know enough about the backroom politics, and there is no non-risky path to doing the right thing here. But, you know, this leads to America's role. I mean, their army has been traditionally heavily dependent on us for its sustenance. It's hard for me to believe that at this very fluid moment, we don't have considerable influence. I'm not talking about Obama giving another damn speech and reversing course for the 35th time. Yeah. I'm talking about a private communication where we say, if Mubarak isn't gone, I mean, you guys have already said, you know, you're ready to assert military control of the country. Fine, do it. If Mubarak isn't gone and if A, B, and C isn't also done, that is the end of the American aid. It seems to me we have the capacity to say that. I can imagine how we have, Obama has all kinds of constituents, foreign and domestic, who are saying, don't say that, because they worry about a post-Mubarak era. But it seems to me that we, in principle, have the leverage to really make a difference here, don't you think?
I think so. But obviously, Hosni Mubarak doesn't. I mean, did you notice in his speech that he actually said, I'm not going to respond, I'm not going to let foreign powers dictate to me what I do or what, you know, what,
yeah,
what happens. That's, in my opinion, that's a veiled allusion to the United States, not to any other country. He's effectively trying, I mean, he's instructed the state television propaganda machine that's been trying to tell people that all these demonstrators are foreign agents working for the CIA, Mossad, Iran, Turkey, Hezbollah, Hamas. I mean, he's lumped everybody together into one kind of grand conspiracy. With the United States in charge. The fact that he believes that he can actually do this, he can stand up to the United States, say this, still expect a $2 billion check each year, and still expect the support from the United States for Egypt, means that he thinks that he's got the upper hand in this. I don't know why he thinks that, but we haven't obviously dissuaded him yet.
One reason is in the post-Mubarak scenario, he's not the one who gets the $2 billion check. I mean, right. I mean, what, the people we should be communicating with, you know, is the Minister of Defense, right?
No, I mean, we have been. We have been. It seems.
Yeah, like, but well, it's a mystery, and you know, it could be something where things changed at the last minute. But what's so strange about it is, you know, this was broadcast over state TV. It seemed in the hours before it that the state TV itself was officially shifting gears to a post-Mubarak era, right?
Right.
Suddenly they were covering the protests, saying nice things about the protesters. All the pieces seemed to be fitting into place. And so you almost get the sense that this was kind of up for grabs. It wasn't clear within the government what was going to happen 2 hours before the speech, you know?
I mean, I think everybody in Egypt is seeing where the momentum is going. I mean, the civil servants are on strike. The journalists who are working for state-run media have insisted
right.
on being free. Al-Ahram, the largest Arab daily, is now actually printing news that's not from the government propaganda. I mean, the momentum has shifted. The president doesn't seem to recognize that the army, which is on the street and should be able to see it visibly with their own eyes, hasn't necessarily picked it up. This speech, I mean, the last time he did this, he gave that speech, he did shift momentum. The demonstrators were a little bit divided. They didn't know whether they should stay or whether they should continue. But then when he called out his goon squad to attack them, that shifted the momentum back towards them. This speech, I think, doesn't even raise any questions in the demonstrators' minds.
No.
This speech is a galvanizing speech, but not the way Hosni Mubarak intended.
Well,
he intended this
especially
speech.
Especially because of the expectations that
right.
preceded it.
Exactly. Exactly. And on a Thursday night, he gave this speech on a Thursday night. Tomorrow's demonstrator. First of all, God knows what's going to happen tonight in Cairo and in Alexandria and in other cities. But tomorrow, I think that the message that Hosni Mubarak actually gave his people today was that the only way you're getting me out is by physically putting me on a plane and sending me out. It's not going to. I'm not willingly stepping away. He's raised the ante.
It wouldn't surprise me if the military winds up doing that in the end. But that's turning out to be the best case scenario. What you said earlier was that, well, I think you suggested, well, maybe this is for the best in the sense that there was a way to transition to a post-Mubarak era that would not have embodied real change. This way, it's binary. It's either, you know, you get real change or you get continued, you know, oppression of a more gruesome form than ever. It's win or lose. Now, I had kind of thought there actually was a kind of middle ground in the following sense. I had thought, look, whatever he says, if there's a post-Mubarak era, even if there are no other concessions, okay, if the protesters could take that as enough of a victory to say, okay, now we start negotiating, and if they could continue to hang on to the lever of being able to call out, you know, stay in the square, keep a presence in the square, and then have the capacity to call out larger numbers if the negotiations go nowhere. I thought maybe that was a way you could get a more gradual transition to an ultimately good outcome. Does that seem wrong to you?
Well, this might have worked if the opposition was actually a very coordinated one with a
right.
strong central leadership that the people could trust to lead the negotiations. But that's not the case. I mean, these are all the Arab dictatorships, and these are autocracies that effectively find people who are leaders and then kill them. I mean, they don't actually allow, you know, real parties to develop and real strong leaders in opposition to develop. And so in Tunisia and in Egypt, what we're seeing are grassroots revolutions, real grassroots revolutions, not ones led by a small elite or a political cadre. And now they're looking to create the leadership in the process of having the revolution, which is, I mean, first of all, a novel exercise and a remarkably difficult one, and we can only wish them the best in actually being able to do it. But because it's happening that way, I think they have no choice but to demand real change that can't be reversed. Any change that Mubarak can take away, if he's the one who allows you to have elections, then he's the one who can also suspend elections. If he's the one who allows you to run for election, he's the one who can also tell you you're unqualified to run for election. If he's the one who's investigating the thugs that beat up and killed people, He's also the one who can send the thugs out to kill people again. And so I think that by demanding his removal from Egypt, they're demanding something that's irreversible. They're saying that we want to make sure that there's no way to go back, no matter whether we flub up the negotiations, no matter whether we end up disagreeing with some of our negotiators in the future. We want to make sure we have an incontrovertible success, an incontrovertible victory. And that would mean that the president has to leave. And barring that, I don't think that they're going to be satisfied.
No. I mean, some might have been satisfied by a mere transfer of authority to Suleiman. That, maybe that's a speech that would have divided them a little. But this is just, it seems to me, destined to rev them up. And maybe the hopeful scenario at this point is that within even hours, maybe it's happening as we speak, but maybe the military sizes up the reaction and says, look, you know, sorry, you know, they take him to a room and say, why don't you have a timeout? And then they announce, you know, the president has taken ill, whatever. And I think that's, I don't know. I mean, that's probably hoping for too much. And then you would further hope that, of course, they would have the wisdom to actually permit a transition to something like true democracy. But I don't know. What do you think is next?
I think that this was probably one of the worst speeches given by a dictator to the largest mass of angry people that we've seen in the last two centuries. And so I don't know what the response is going to be. I do know that the speech is most likely to galvanize the public to double down and push harder for his removal. The longer the army sticks on the wrong side, and this is basically the trouble and the challenge that the Obama administration has had. If you're standing on the sidelines and people think they want you to be the hero, they want you to be the good guy, but you stand on the side for too long and do nothing, then you become the bad guy. And the army right now, the army was about to be, if Mubarak had resigned and announced that the army was taking over and transitioning to democracy, the army would have been the hero. It would have been the hero for all of Egypt. The Egyptians would have been applauding. They would have been on top of tanks, hugging soldiers, etc. Instead, they now are looking at those soldiers and they're saying, wait a minute, which side are you on? And I think, again, whatever the president, I don't know if the president so far, President Obama has been giving speeches immediately after Hosni Mubarak gives speeches. I'm not sure that's such a great idea, but if the next time the president, President Obama gives a speech, if it's once again this kind of vacillating where the audience isn't quite certain which side the United States is on, I think that ultimately we might find ourselves in the same position as the Egyptian army, which is that people want us to be the good guy, but maybe they may end up determining that we're not.
Do you think there is genuine ambivalence within the Obama administration? I mean, he does have some constituents who fear the post-Mubarak era. Do you get the sense that actually the administration has finally made up its mind we need real democracy in Egypt?
I think that they've made up their mind that we need a change from Hosni Mubarak. I don't think that they've made up their mind that they need real democracy in Egypt. That would be unfortunate. But it is real democracy that is the issue, and it's not just changing one face for another.
Right.
And I don't think that they're there yet. I want to ask this one question. Imagine that this revolution in Egypt was happening, and last year, imagine that the United States had succeeded in ending the Arab-Israeli conflict, and Israel had a peace treaty with 22 Arab states. Mm-hmm. Today, the revolution in Egypt would still be happening, but the United States would not be hamstrung. We wouldn't be terrified, worrying about what this might mean if we supported freedom, if we supported democracy. Oh, my God, what if we support free assembly inside Egypt? What does that mean for America? We wouldn't be worried because it would be clear that that would be good for us. The only reason that we stand here confused, that we make two steps forward, one step backward, we're not sure whether to support dictatorship or democracy, is because we haven't actually also been able to get a handle on that issue. And I think we've got to start thinking 10 years down the road, 20 years from down the road. You can't just make the decision. This is a historic moment in the Middle East. You can't just make the decision as to which side you're going to support based on very, very narrow domestic political considerations. You've got to look at America's overarching national interests for the future.
Mm-hmm. So you think Israel is at the center of what ambivalence there is in the administration?
Yes. Because, to be honest, Israel's not the only country, of course. Saudi Arabia, King Abdullah, King Abdullah of Jordan, the United Arab Emirates, they've all called the president and they've weighed in and they've, you know, begged him to continue supporting the military regime. It's just hard for me to believe that those other voices, the Arab voices, were something that keep up, you know, to keep the president and his team up at night worrying, oh my God, I think we're going to have to support this military regime because these other
They don't keep his campaign team up for the night. They don't keep his political advisors up for the night. Now, they may make it easier for him psychologically to say, yeah, there's a lot of people who are worried about this, and stability is important. But my view is just that, look, it's so clear where history is heading. It's clear to me that technology has a lot to do with this, and that's the reason you're not going to put the genie back in the bottle. And whether it's 2 years or 4 years or 8 years down the road, you know, democracy is going to be what you see in the Arab world. And Arab opinion is going to matter, and we're not helping ourselves by getting Arabs to take a darker and darker and darker view of us, because pretty soon they're going to be controlling the instruments of state. Even if it's not democracy tomorrow, Arab governments are going to be more responsive to the opinion on the street because they're all scared now, all the leaders. Right. And so already I think you're going to see a shift of some policies as a result of this, but certainly in the long run, you know, Arab opinion is going to matter. And it's one of many cases where I think it's not there is not tension between Israel's true interests and America's. I think Israel too needs to get on the right side of history and recognize that it cannot continue to live in this state of siege. And that the way to short-circuit the problem is to strike a two-state deal, even if, or some kind of deal, even if it's not on what would have seemed optimal terms a year ago. Time is running out.
Do we not disagree? I agree with you. You can't look at the pictures in Cairo right now that are being broadcast all over the world, except I think in China where they're blocking all news out of Egypt. You can't actually have the whole world watching what's happening right now in Egypt. And it's clear. Everybody knows who the good guy is. Everybody knows who the bad guy is. It's not a question about whether the United States can engineer a coup or whether the United States can engineer the outcome of Egypt. We can't. But we can pick sides. We can actually, you know, we can ally our principles with our policies. Mm-hmm. And I think that we're very lucky. The Arab world are very much like the Eastern European satellite countries for the Soviet Union, except they're our satellites. They're America's satellites.
Mm-hmm.
But unlike the Soviet Union, it's possible that these countries can become free and still love the country that was the former Soviet Union in this respect.
Yeah.
So
the
former hegemon. We can have the Arabs be free and still love the United States. But that's not going to happen if every time this revolution in Egypt is not going to be the last one, most likely. And every time somebody looks in the mirror, and they're trying to figure out which side the United States is on. Even our reporters, I mean, it's not even our own reporters can't keep up the myth of, well, it's the Muslim Brotherhood, and, well, we don't know, and it's a dangerous situation, and the crowds, you know, they could be anti-American, because they've been there, and they've been among the crowds, and they know that it's not anti-American. They know that, mm-hmm. that the whole demonstrations are asking for freedom. And
you've seen
a change in the reporting that CNN and others have done just over the last week. You've seen how that reporting has shifted once they actually put reporters on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, in general, the fear of this being a radical religious thing, it has been just about as secular a thing as you could have possibly expected. Largely, of course, there are, you know, religion is involved. The Muslim Brotherhood is involved. But, I mean, it seems to me interesting that the symbolic face of this has become this Google executive, you know. I mean,
there's a nice symmetry to it.
Yeah. So I know you've got to go right now, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I will let you go. Thanks for finding the time, Amjad.
Thanks.
And I hope we'll talk soon in a sunnier context.
Thanks. Maybe tomorrow.
Maybe so. Maybe it'll be sunny tomorrow. Take care.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.